You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Psychologists Philip Zimbardo and John Boyd say that time is our most valuable asset and that our deep-seated, unexamined perspectives on time profoundly influence the course of our lives. Their new book, The Time Paradox, examines and evaluates those underlying beliefs. It's published by Free Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Philip Zimbardo back to the show. Hi.
Great to be back, Leonard.
Well, with that in mind, what I've just said, do any of us really have the time to read this book?
I hope so. See, life is really all about what was, what is, what will be. But those time zones are really manufactured in your mind. It's not what the clock measures. And the time paradox, the reason we call it that is I argue that the most powerful influences on your everyday decisions are something you're unaware of, the fact that you have developed a bias to focus excessively on the future, the present, or the past. And that bias influences little decisions as well as big ones. And the other problem is that if you're excessively focused on one of those time zones, it has lots of good things. If you're future-oriented, you're going to be successful in school and business usually. If you focus on the present, hedonism, you're going to have friends and fun and live. If you focus on the past, that's where you're hooked up to family, to your identity. But in the extreme, you're stuck in the past. You don't want change. In the extreme, if you're present hedonistic, you're open to all addictions. In the extreme, if you're future-oriented, you sacrifice the three Fs, friends, family, and fun for your success. And so we talk.
And you say it leads to addictions in time.
Oh, yeah.
In some cases.
And so see, the point is that it's really, the whole book points to the need to have a temporal balance, that not to be a slave to one of those time zones.
The last time you were here, we talked about your book, The Lucifer Effect, about the torture experiments at Stanford that you were involved with. How did you get from that to a book about the study of time? Is there a link?
Yeah, well, there's two links. When I was doing the Stanford prison experiment, all of our time sense got distorted because the prisoners would be woken up every few hours. And there was only me and two graduate students running this experiment, which went 24 hours, you know, 7 days a week. And our time sense got distorted because I would go to sleep in my office for a few hours, get up. And I began to realize that your sense of time is really constantly being manufactured. The other personal influence is I grew up in the South Bronx from a family of Sicilian origin. And most of the family, most poor people, live in the present zone. They're either present hedonistic for kids, you live for the day, you have fun, and parents are present fatalistic. That is, they say, nothing makes a difference, I'm the last to be hired, the first to be fired. But because they don't have a future orientation, then you're stuck in the ghetto.
So it's also the circumstances of our lives that affect the way we view time.
Oh, really? Absolutely.
Class can be a factor, for example.
Yeah, I mean, you do not become middle class unless you have a healthy future orientation. You stay stuck in the lower class if you don't develop some future orientation. But also climate has an impact. The closer you live to the equator, the more present-oriented you are because things don't change. If you live in paradise, you're stuck in the present, if you will. Education influences time perspective. The more educated you are, the more likely you are to be future-oriented.
That's why some people who move to Los Angeles, want to come back to the East because they say, I miss the seasons.
Yeah, and the seasons are really preparing. I mean, your mind, if you live in a place where there's change, climate change, other kinds of change, you're in the background of your mind, you're like this little squirrel. You're collecting nuts for the winter. But if you live in a place where nothing changes, then every day is like yesterday. Every tomorrow is like today.
Well, time is an amorphous concept, and a lot of philosophers have gotten involved. And probably the greatest work of French literature in the 20th century was influenced by one of those philosophers, Bergson. Proust's book was all about time.
Yeah. That essentially, I mean, what all of depression, all clinical depression, which is, you know, the common cold now of mental illness, is people being stuck in a negative past, ruminating. In every new situation, you remind me of my uncle who abused me, or you remind me of my teacher who failed me. And other people, it's always bringing in the positives. You remind me of my brother Don, who I love, or you remind me of my sister Vera. So you bring in to each new situation either the negatives from the past, and essentially for some people, their mind is like a Smithsonian of horrors. And for other people, it's the joy, the nostalgia of the good old days. And you're unaware of it. You're unaware of how your reconstruction of the past. Again, most things that you remember of the past either never happened or never happened the way you think of them.
You open your book with the description of the basement of Santa Maria della Concezione, a church in Rome. What were the Cappuccine monks who built it seeking to illustrate?
Well, essentially, you know, one of the main principles of most churches are, I mean, most religions, is to make you aware of your mortality. That is, when you're living, each of us has a sense we're going to live forever. And therefore, we can put off taking time for good deeds and sacrifice, and you know, and enjoy the, in quote, the sins of the flesh, you know, good times. And it's an awareness of your mortality to say you will not live forever, and therefore there will be a point at which, you know, there's going to be a decision, heaven or hell. You know, resist temptation and you're going to go to heaven. Give in to temptation and you're southbound.
Do you think that when people thought more about heaven and hell, when it was such a basic part of the culture and every painter had to do a painting that compared the two, that people were more aware of that aspect of time?
I think so. I mean, you know, in our current generation, with the exception of, again, kids who are in a drug culture who realize, you know, their life is, if they live past 25, they're lucky. For most of us, we really have almost an unconscious sense that we could live forever, so that science is going to give us a pill.
Except those people who write novels about the end times.
Well, yeah, but people read those less and less now, I think, because, you know, again, you know, our whole culture is living for the American culture, certainly living to be perpetually youthful, I mean, with Botox and all kinds of creams and stuff.
Well, you've said that we actually are better at handling our money than we are in handling our time, although in recent years it seems to have, the two seem to have evened out. We hear now the people, so many people living on credit. It's kind of like living on borrowed time, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, time is money is one of the phrases. Actually, there was a big poster in Merrill Lynch in Palo Alto, where I teach at Stanford, and it had this big sign, time is money. Well, in part, we think about time as a commodity. We think about it, we spend it, we waste it, we lose it. And in fact, the recent meltdown in Wall Street is really about greed. I mean, what greed does, the psychological motive of greed is, it makes you live in a short-term, in a present or short-term future, is that even when you know at some level that you have to have reserve, you have to have liquidity, you have to have, you know, money in the bank before you can make all these loans. Here are these bank presidents, these big people in mortgage firms, Fannie Mae, Fannie Mac, who, they were told 2 years ago, you don't have enough reserve. And they're saying, well, but look, we can make this sale, we can make this killing. So greed takes people who are usually future-oriented, who plan for the future wisely, and makes them live for the moment, go for the kill.
Even the most sophisticated people are sometimes taken in by Ponzi schemes, and it turns out that this whole housing mortgage bubble was a Ponzi scheme, in effect. But do you think that Americans tend to look at wealth as evidence that people have spent their time well?
Yeah, see, this comes from the big movement that moved people to become capitalists came out of the Reformation, out of the Puritan Reformation, Calvinism specifically. That the Calvinist orientation was that all of us are predestined to heaven or hell. And this index, the sign that you are predestined to heaven, is your success on earth. And so, therefore, people really work their butts off to be successful on earth, to prove not only to themselves but to everybody else, look, I'm going to heaven. And that really started the psychological foundation for capitalism, for you know, a future orientation where people are willing to sacrifice the present for gains in the future.
My guest is Philip Zimbardo, who has written with John Boyd, The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Will Change Your Life, published by Free Press. So, but can we really apply economic principles to a discussion of the science of time?
Yeah, I think so. Like, one of the basic principles in economics is discounting, is that discounting functions, that you essentially weigh, what do I get now by taking a particular action, by making a certain decision, and what is the gain and cost in the future? Let me tell you about a wonderful little experiment. It's called the marshmallow experiment. And in this experiment, children are given a marshmallow as a treat. And they're told, you can eat it right now, but if you wait till I come back, you can have two. Well, clearly it makes sense, if you like it, to wait. But waiting is in the future. And so here's a really temptation versus delay of gratification. Before the age of four, no child can wait, because partly the brain has to develop the frontal lobes, which you plan for the future. At the age of four, about half the kids wait and half don't.
This is what Freud would have explained as a development of the superego.
It's a development. And what the superego is, exactly that. It's internalization of an imagined future, which says, you know, I can't give in to this thing now, even though it's tempting. But the important thing is, 14 years later, Walter Mischel, who was the psychology professor at Stanford who did this research with four-year-olds, he goes back and he interviews these kids. They're now, you know, in college. There are enormous differences. The kids who gave into temptation versus the kids who resisted. The kids who resisted scored 250 points higher on the SATs, on verbal and math. They were able to resist frustration throughout life. The kids who could not resist, we call them the present-oriented kids, got in trouble more often. They scored lower intellectually, had poorer grades in school. So this simple test at the age of four, can you resist temptation or can you not delay gratification, predicts enormously a path that you're going to begin to take throughout life.
So why aren't school systems using it all the time? You can automatically spot the troublemakers of the future.
Well, because they're not really sensitive to these kinds of issues. I mean, part of the time paradox is once you're aware of it, it becomes obvious. But because time is all around us, it's really like fish swimming in the sea, is that they never notice the water, that time is really the medium, which I'm arguing governs our life, but we're unaware of it.
Well, there's a third kid, perhaps. I don't know if there is. The one who says is, you know, there's too much sugar in the marshmallow, and I'm not going to eat it because it's going to be bad for my teeth and make me fat.
Yeah, well those are the ones.
That's the kid who becomes president of the United States?
Well, not the current president of the United States, no. But, yeah, there's the kid who says, I really like it. I'm going to take it home. I'm going to have it for dessert, or I'm going to cut it in half and have a little now and a little later. Or I'm going to, if I wait, I'm going to have two. I'll give one to my brother and I'll take one. Those are the really future-oriented kids. So, but what we find in our research is that I developed a scale called the Zimbardo Time Perspective Inventory that actually gives you a profile of the extent to which your past positive or past negative, present hedonistic or fatalistic, future-oriented, but you can also be future-oriented focusing on life after death. We call that transcendental future.
So you ask questions? What kinds of
questions
do you ask?
Yeah, there are 56 questions about, it's just how characteristic of me are the following sentences. When I think of the past, I think about all the good times, or I think about all the regrets and abuse. I easily give in to temptation. I can resist temptation when I know there's work to be done. And so you answer on these items, and then you get a score on each of these profiles, on each of these six domains.
Would this apply to people all over the world, or is this something that would be very specific to the people who come out of the Western European tradition?
Well, see, that's what I thought. That is, we developed a scale in the United States, but now it's being translated into 24 different languages. I just came back from Berlin, and there was a conference with people from 12 cultures, from Lithuania, from Russia, from Peru, and they're all getting significant effects.
So it doesn't matter what your religion is and what your... you said climate does have an effect.
Oh, no, religion. Well, Protestants are more future-oriented than Catholics throughout the world. Geography has an effect, the closer you are to the equator.
What about growing up in a richer, a country that is affluent as opposed to one that's struggling?
Oh, see, that's critical because to be future-oriented—
In this country, we're going to have both those experiences in my lifetime.
We're going to have the extremes. I hope this is not going to be the rerun of 1929, but— See, to be future-oriented really means two things. You have to have trust in the future. That is, you have to be in an economically and politically stable environment, and you have to be in a relatively stable family environment. Because if your father says, if you're a good boy, I'll buy you a bike, and you're a good boy, and he comes home, and I say, where's my bike? He said, I lost my job, or it was stolen. Then he no longer is somebody I'm going to deal with. I'm not going to trust him. I can still love him, but I'm not going to trust him. And so I'm not going to become as future-oriented as kids who say, you know, my parents deliver on their promises.
My guess is Philip Zimbardo, who's professor emeritus at Stanford University, past president of the American Psychological Association. He has written with John Boyd, who is also at Stanford, a book called The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Will Change Your Life, published by the Free Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Philip Zimbardo, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Lucifer Effect, now co-author with John Boyd of The Time Paradox, which is published by Free Press. Is one of the problems that time is intangible, unlike money, it can't be accumulated or doubled or saved?
Yeah, it's something you construct in your mind, and we really reconstruct it each day. And what we're trying to say is you really have to appreciate more fully your conception of time. That the first step is just an awareness of, am I really stuck in the past? Am I living too much in the present? Is my life focused on tomorrow? Therefore, I never enjoy today. I don't enjoy the friends.
I have all three family. Of those problems. How do I work that out?
Oh, my God. Well, you're going to have to see a therapist. My son Adam is a good one.
I don't have the time.
one of the problems is exactly this. 20 years ago, USA Today did a survey called the Time Crunch, and it showed Americans feel that there's not enough time. I had them redo the survey this year. And they published it August the 5th in the USA Today. And it's amazing. I mean, 70% of Americans say this year was busier than last year, and last year was busier than the year before. And everybody says, I don't have enough time. But the problem then is, what do you sacrifice? And the majority of people sacrifice family, friends. 57% of these 2,000 people on the survey said, I sacrifice sleep. Well, that's a recipe for health disaster. And so we are too future-oriented.
Well, I'm confused a bit because, yeah, everybody, I think the new one-upmanship is I'm too busy, I can't do that. At the same time, I've also read that Americans spend 8 hours a day watching television.
Yeah, but those are two different groups of people. I mean, the hedonists are the ones who spend 8 hours watching television. They're the ones who max out on their credit cards. I mean, we're massively in debt as a nation, and that's going to cause long-term problems. So essentially, when you say Americans, I mean, Americans are these chunks of those who live in the past, those who live in the present, those who live in the future. And it's the future-oriented people who really run the country. They're the ones who make these decisions. But where it's a short-term future, where it's you're living for the quarterly report or the stock report, so your whole world, the future is only the next 3 months. And we should be having a long-term future. Or politicians who live for their two-year term and therefore don't want to put any investment in a long-term future.
Or Donald Rumsfeld, who lived for a six-month war.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's gone on for nearly 6 years.
Is it still going on? Yeah, I'm surprised.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
Why do you say that the human physiology is antiquated?
Well,
you say humans are cognitive misers.
Oh, well, because essentially what we try to do is simplify every situation. I mean, you know, the human mind is this incredible organ that you know, deals with enormous input, but we're cognitive misers in that we want to simplify situations. We're always looking for how does this, you know, we're looking for schemas. We're looking for how can we deal with this something new? I'm always putting new things into old frameworks, and sometimes they don't fit. And that becomes a problem, you know, where the new doesn't fit in with the old. So the mind is wonderful, but it's not adapting as quickly to our new technology, to our changes in the way our lives are being orchestrated.
I would imagine that the Industrial Revolution had a major impact on people's sense of time because you were going from an agrarian society where time was the sun comes up, and then at a certain, the sun is up in the high in the sky, and then it gets dark and you go to sleep.
Oh, absolutely.
To something where you had to show up at work at a certain time and the whistle blew and you took lunch and the whistle blew and you went back to work and the whistle blew and you went home.
Yeah. I mean, most people in America live an 8-to-5 world, I mean, who have jobs. And that we think of that as the day. The day is – and that's the work day. But before, especially if you go to any European country, there's – every European major city has these enormous clocks, these city hall clocks. And they really not only tell the time of day, it's they have the seasons, because it was a time to sow and a time to reap and a time to gather, and that you organize your life around seasonal changes. And then with the Industrial Revolution, you organize your life around the workday. And, you know, if you were lucky, you got a week off or 2 weeks off, and then you organize your life around the vacation that's coming in the summer. And we begin to believe that that's what time is, but that's you don't realize that's imposed on us.
Isn't that changing again with the reliance on computers and people, in some cases, working on their own time schedules?
Yeah, computers are changing everything. And that's what I'm saying. This new technology, it's not clear that the mind is catching up fast enough that people work around the world. I mean, you could now be a stockbroker and, you know, you got to be on the computer at 3 a.m. because the stock market's opening in Korea or something, you know, at that time. But also it's because of the instantaneous interactions on the computer, it really compresses time in a whole new way. That in the survey at USA Today, one of the things people got upset about is how long it waiting for a web page to download or waiting for your computer to boot up. You're talking about seconds. So now
people, right. In the past, you had to go and find a book on a shelf. Now you're annoyed that Google hasn't given it to you instantaneously.
Yeah, you went to the library. You filled out a form. You searched the stacks. You got a book. You brought it home. You opened it. And now, you're right, you know, you see a book, you order it on Amazon, and they're not going to deliver it for 2 whole days, you know, to your door. So it's really a strange mix of instant gratification. We want things instantly and now. And in part, we're overwhelmed by the amount of information that is available instantly and now.
My guest is Philip Zimbardo with John Boyd. He's written The Time Paradox. And it is published by Free Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A lot of psychologists have been looking into this. Why have so many people been thinking about time in relation to our psychological makeup?
Well, I think, you know, although a lot of psychologists have been interested in this over years, it's really never been a major area of study. In part because we never had a way to measure it. We never had a metric of this what I'm calling time perspective. And really, time perspective is how the human mind partitions the flow of our experiences into these time zones. And I think so with the scale that I developed, which is highly reliable, it's been tested, as I said, in many countries, but also we do research. We pick out people who are past versus future versus present, and we show that behavior is very different.
And what is the significance of a person's first memory in your work?
Now, that varies a lot because some people don't even have memories before they're 6 years old.
And some are unreliable, aren't they? I know most. Some of my early memories probably, maybe they're real, but they're probably things that people told me occurred when I was young, and then I've just taken them as my own memory.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, see, one of the things we argue about is say, gee, well, somebody has a past negative orientation. There are all these terrible things that happened to them. Well, in a sense, we're talking about you have created in your mind the memory of something. And in most cases, it was not as bad as you remember. That you remember your father rejected you. And in fact, if you go back and talk to people who were there, it was just he was working hard. He commuted a long time. He came home. He jumped on his lap. And he said, later. And then you say, well, did he reject you? Or what did he do later? Well, he did put me to sleep. He told me a story. But you simply have coded that as a child negatively because you were so anxious for him to love you.
And we see this sometimes when siblings talk about their youth. And one says, Dad was just terrible. And the other one said, no, actually, he was kind of nice. Right.
Well, Elizabeth Loftus, who's a psychologist at UC, Irvine, has done a whole series of studies showing how unreliable memory is. She's often an expert in eyewitness crime cases. And, you know, people say, this is what I remember, this is what I saw. And she shows that in a high percentage of cases, people's recall is totally false. Or you can tell them about, to describe some memory they have of being at Disneyland and meeting Pluto or Mickey Mouse or some, you know, turns out they're not at Disneyland. But you remember this. You give this whole elaboration.
Does it matter whether we're talking about the far distant past or something that happened fairly recently?
Well, it's easy to distort the far distant past because there's less clues in around you. But there are people who constantly are distorting it because a lot of what you remember is based on your expectation. You expect a certain thing to happen, and it doesn't. So it's a violation of expectation, and it's highlighted. For other things, it's habitual. That is, it happens, you hardly even notice it, where somebody else in the same situation is, oh, my God, that's terrible.
How do you suggest people go about changing their perspectives of the past?
Well, what we're arguing is that for some people, I mean, people who are present or future-oriented, they have to redevelop a sense of the past. And so we're arguing they have to take time to talk to family, friends. One of the most wonderful things you could do is start an oral history of your family. Simply interviewing grandma, grandpa, your father, your mother. Most kids have not a clue what their parents' life was like before they were born. You know, that they had a whole life, that they were people before they were, in quote, parents. And just taking the time to do an oral history not only connects you to your past, but really, in most cases, opens your eyes to the whole new realm of human relationships.
You mentioned expectation as being a key factor. It works in other ways as well. Can you describe Robert Rosenthal's experiment regarding teachers and expectations of their students?
Yeah. So Robert Rosenthal is a social psychologist. He was at Harvard, and he worked with a principal, Lenore Jacobson. And they go in to various classrooms, and they give a test, and then they tell the teacher that the following kids are late bloomers. Even though they have not performed very well, we have a sense that from all of our measurements, these are the kids who are going to bloom. It turns out by the end of the year, these kids are getting the top scores, the teacher's pet. And it turns out they just picked those kids randomly, that they were not special anyway. And so the teacher's expectations that certain kids would perform well, would be outstanding, changed the teacher's behavior toward them. So the teacher asked them more questions, encouraged them more, and then the kids actually develop more. So expectations can actually shape behavior.
I feel sorry for the kids who weren't the late bloomers.
Yeah, and they were stuck in the back of the room. They were the placebos.
What is a transcendental future?
Well, in some religions, the important thing is the pie in the sky when you die. That is, in fact, you live your life. Many Catholics do. I grew up a Catholic. Many Catholics do. It's the good things are going to happen when you die. And in fact, a lot of religions, that's kind of the palliative, is that even though you're suffering, even though you're poor, even though, you know, you've been abused, when you die, there'll be a place for you next to God or next to Allah. And so the transcendental future, we have a scale that measures the extent to which people believe in that, that organize their life around choices which are going to get you to heaven, get you to avoid hell.
Or to lead you to be to become a one of the more favored animals after you go through, you know, if you're a Buddhist, for example,
oh, yeah,
you're going to come back a cow rather than a cockroach.
Yeah. Yes. So essentially it's planning, but it's planning each day not for success tomorrow, but success after you die.
Well, since your book also talks about the effect that it can have on your life, how can your time orientation affect your health?
Oh, in many, many ways. Research we have from Italy shows that women who are future-oriented are much more likely to go for breast cancer checkups than women from the same social class who are more present-oriented. People who are future-oriented are more likely to eat health foods. They floss their teeth. I mean, flossing your teeth is an act of faith. I mean, nobody ever said if you don't floss your teeth are going to fall. Present-oriented people are less likely to floss their teeth. So you get health checkups, you get medical checkups, you get pap smears, breast cancer. And so you're going to live longer if you're future-oriented than if you're present-oriented.
Are people who are educated more likely to be future-oriented?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the main goals of most education is to take little beastie present-oriented kids. I mean, all of us we all begin at the breast or the bottle, and we live for pleasure and to avoid pain. some of us stay in that zone, that our whole life is pleasure and pain. But school is really about delaying gratification. I mean, everything in school is about, you know, working hard to get a gold star, working hard to get a grade at the end of the term.
So how do we explain all those highly educated people who worked at Enron and more recently at Merrill Lynch and Bear Stearns and the Lehman Brothers and the debacle that they brought upon themselves? Did they forget that they should be future-oriented, or did they just assume that the future was going to be like a Ponzi scheme and they were just going to continue to make more and more money?
Well, it's really interesting because those people don't get those jobs unless they're very future-oriented, meaning they have to have been successful in school, in business school, in law school. But at some point, they get trapped in a system where everybody around them is, you know, the goal is to make money. And all the problem in all these businesses, the main goal is to make as much money as possible and to make more money than the other company. And so, again, as I said, it's partly the greed that focus you on a short-term future rather than a long-term future. It's making the buck today so that you can go to the stockbroker and say, look, you know, look at the great things we did, therefore give us a raise, give us a bonus.
And nobody's worrying about whether the insurance company is going to be able to pay off later when the whole thing falls apart.
Right. But even the accountants. I mean, the accountant's job, you know, especially, and also board of directors, I mean, that's their job.
Well, isn't a regulator's job in the future this is going to be a real problem?
Yeah, I mean, accountants, regulators, board of directors, their main focus has to be the long-term future. And they have to be the one that sounds the alarm. Wait a minute, you can't do something that seems good, looks good, feels good now because it could be a disaster.
And after the disaster, all those people are suddenly past-oriented.
Oh, yeah.
Gee, I shoulda, I coulda, didn't do it. Philip Zimbardo's latest book, written with John Boyd, is The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Will Change Your Life, published by Free Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Leonard, it's wonderful to be here. You have such a great program.